Washington has seen it all. But there are those events that some folks say are a
game changer.
It's going to be a game changer.
I do think that this has the potential to be a game changer.
But this should be a game changer.
And even at a time when every news event seems like it's bigger than the last, Justice Anthony Kennedy's retirement seems like an actual real game changer.
Justice Anthony Kennedy, a very special guy also, just announced a little while ago his retirement from the United States Supreme Court. Great man. And I'm very honored that he chose to do it during my term in office because he felt confident in me to make the right choice and carry on his great legacy. That's why he did it.
But is this moment the game changer we think it is? I'm Amy Walter, and today on The Takeaway, the fight for the next Supreme Court justice just weeks ahead of the 2018 midterm elections. As Justice Anthony Kennedy, the crucial swing vote on the court, retires, he leaves a vacancy on the Supreme Court. And some say that means
President Trump will choose a nominee who will be anti-choice. I think we can be 100% sure of that.
It also means
Kennedy leaving at this moment is going to absolutely lead to a greater investment by conservative voters of all stripes in this political cycle.
So who will it galvanize? Republican voters excited for the chance for another conservative justice? Or will it further energize Democrats who are already fighting a GOP-controlled White House and Congress? Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell holds the reins for the next few months, but it wasn't that long ago he made his case that President Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland, couldn't be confirmed in an election year.
We're in the process of picking a president, and that new president ought to make this appointment, which will affect the Supreme Court maybe for the next quarter of a century.
But today, he says it's not the same.
This is not 2016. There aren't the final months of a second-term constitutionally lame-duck presidency with a presidential election fast approaching.
And some Democrats say the Mueller investigation complicates things.
The President of the United States right now is a subject of an ongoing criminal investigation, an investigation that every member of this committee knows could end up before the Supreme Court.
Here to help make sense of all of this is Todd Ruger. He's a legal affairs staff director for CQ and Roll Call. Carol Doherty, he's the director of political research at the Pew Research Center. And Nancy Ognatovich, she's a congressional leadership reporter for Bloomberg Government. Welcome to you all.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Nancy, I want to start with you. I want you to help us understand Mitch McConnell for a second. Back in 2016, when there was another vacancy after Justice Scalia's death, McConnell said, nope, we can't have a vote. This is an election year. We need to wait till the people have their say. Now we are in 2018, also an election year, and McConnell says, well, this is different. So how does that work?
Successfully, he makes a distinction that that was a presidential year and a new president should have the ability to put forward a nominee, whereas this is a rather ordinary midterm election where it's, you know, the Senate and the House where you see the races. So that's his distinction. And I think he's getting away with that argument. I don't think that even though Democrats have protested that, they'll get very far with their argument that it's that the same standards should apply.
Though a Supreme Court justice cannot be confirmed without the Senate, and the Senate is on the ballot. A third of senators are on the ballot this year.
That's right. Control of the Senate is at stake here, and McConnell wants to do all he can during the period of time he's assured of being in the majority to get more conservative jurists on the bench, whether it's the Supreme Court or the appeals courts or the district courts. He's going after all of them. Right now, the Senate was going to be out a lot of October for campaigning for the midterm election, but we expect that they will push hard to get a vote on this before the election.
Is it your sense that Democrats are going to try anything else? We played a clip earlier of Senator Cory Booker saying, well, maybe the president shouldn't even be able to put anybody on the Supreme Court because of the investigation going on surrounding the Russia interference in the campaign. Do you think this gets any traction at all?
I don't think so. It's really good, I suppose, for the arguments that energize their base, but I don't think that that argument is going to go very far.
Carol, this argument about energizing the base, I've been hearing from Republicans for a while now that they really needed something to juice up the energy of their base because Democrats have been shown to be much more interested and engaged in the election thus far. Is it likely that a Supreme Court opening will be that juice they needed?
You know, it has the potential to energize people on both sides. Typically, Republicans have cared more about the court than Democrats. And this has the potential to do it for both sides. But I think, you know, especially among white evangelical voters who are so key to the Republican coalition in any election in 2018 and any election, that's, I think, what they're eyeing as they go forward.
Why do you think that Republicans have historically been more interested in control of the Supreme Court or what goes on in the Supreme Court than Democrats?
Well, I think some of it has to do with these social issues that are front and center before the court. And I think Republicans, obviously, especially white evangelicals, take very conservative positions on a lot of those issues, same-sex marriage, abortion, things like that. This is kind of the battleground for a lot of those issues. And, Democrats, by and large, I have to say a little note on the side here. Americans really don't follow the court all that closely from year to year. They follow the big decisions. So they don't know a lot about the court in the same way they know a lot about, say, Donald Trump and leading politicians, in part because the court's not on TV. So what gets attention are these big decisions especially about social issues.
Todd, I want to talk to you about some of the potential names of justices. There is a so-called short list, maybe 20, 25 names that President Trump is likely to turn to look for the next justice. Can you tell us where this short list came from?
Yeah, sure. If you go back to the election, President Trump made the Supreme Court one of his priorities in his campaign. And he talked about that was one of the reasons Republicans should vote for him. And he got to deliver on that with Neil Gorsuch. Neil Gorsuch was picked off of a list that Trump first created during the campaign. He updated it in November, and so there's about 20 to 25 lists names on the list. It comes through Leonard Leo, who is an advisor to the White House on judicial nominees. He was with the Federalist Society, but he's taking a break now, and he will be advising Trump on these picks. So these are all solidly, reliably conservative names on this list.
Can you walk through a couple of those names, and are they the same people that you see as a potential pick?
Yeah, so out of those 25 names, four, five, six maybe are bubbling up. That includes somebody like Senator Mike Lee, which would create quite an interesting confirmation process and vote. But the more traditional names on the list, one of them that catches most people's eyes is Brett Kavanaugh. He's an appeals court judge here in Washington. He's got a really solid record on administrative law and environmental law. He's long been sort of a darling of the right and the conservatives when it comes to who might be the next Supreme Court pick. He was not originally on Trump's names of 20 people during the campaign, so he was just added in November. One of the things that gets me about that is he's a former Justice Kennedy clerk. There's another name on the list, Raymond Kethledge. He's an appeals court judge on the Sixth Circuit, and he also was a Kennedy clerk. There's a woman named Amy Barrett, who was recently confirmed to the Seventh Circuit. Trump appointed her to the Seventh Circuit, and she lives in Indiana, which is giving rise to some speculation that she might get picked. She's also thought to be very solidly against Roe v. Wade. And then another name I might throw out there is Judge Amul Thapar. He's also in the Sixth Circuit, but he comes from Kentucky. So that's Mitch McConnell's state, and that Mitch McConnell might be pulling for him.
Todd, we've already seen a number of outside groups saying that they're going to spend a lot of money. This is both from the conservative and liberal side to try to influence, I guess, the votes of senators whenever this vote ultimately takes place. Can you talk to us a little bit about the money that's going into this and whether and how it becomes effective?
Sure. Just as you were speaking about the Republicans being more energized about the Supreme Court, they're more organized when it comes to backing judicial confirmations. There's a group called the Judicial Crisis Network. on the right that was involved, first of all, about $7 million in blocking Obama's pick of Merrick Garland to be on the bench. And then they say they spent $10 million to back Justice Gorsuch's confirmation. And they have already purchased more than $1 million of ads targeting vulnerable Democratic senators when it comes to whoever gets nominated this time. There's also a Koch Brothers affiliated group that has said they were going to spend seven figures on advertising on this. On the other side, you have Demand Justice. This is a group that was just formed in May as a sort of a response to the Judicial Crisis Network. They have a goal of raising $10 million in their first year, but this could certainly boost that effort, and they plan on doing advertisements. Both sides plan on doing big grassroots campaign, getting out the voters, having them call their senators. The pressure on one side is going to be for the Democrats to keep all of the Democrats together and maybe pick off one or two Republicans. The energy on the right is just going to be keeping those Republicans together. And in each case, they're just going to let them know that there are consequences electorally for their votes.
Todd, how many serious targets are there in terms of folks who could be on the fence or who could be influenced by a campaign?
By my count, there are five major ones. On the Democratic side, you've got Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, Joe Manchin in West Virginia, and Joe Donnelly in Indiana. Those three voted for Justice Gorsuch when he was in confirmation last year. Justice Gorsuch ended up getting 54 votes. And those three are currently running for re-election in states that Trump won. There's also Bill Nelson, who's in a tough race down in Florida. And then on the right, Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins are the ones that might have concerns about a nominee that goes too far in appearing to constrict access to abortion.
And Murkowski and Collins voted against the Republican Obamacare repeal bill as well.
Correct. So there's some people on the left are focusing on, we can maybe highlight how the health care will be affected by this decision, and that will be able to pick off a couple of Republicans based on that. But if you look at their votes on all of the lower court nominees that Trump has put up, which all Democrats have all said are mostly against Roe v. Wade, they've supported those. On the other hand, the Supreme Court is in its own universe. It's a much bigger deal.
So, Todd, do you see that then as an issue that is going to be front and center at these confirmation hearings? And if so, can you talk to us a little bit about how the issue of Roe v. Wade and abortion has developed as a line of questioning for potential Supreme Court justices?
Yeah, sure. There is no doubt that this is going to be one of the premier issues at this confirmation hearing. When Neil Gorsuch, Trump's first pick, went through his confirmation hearings, it was definitely a topic. If you remember, Trump promised to appoint justices who would overturn Roe v. Wade. So it was clearly a question that he was going to be asked. When he was asked, he did what justices have done for years, which is he avoided saying what his personal view on this was. He said Roe v. Wade is the law of the land. He was also pressed, this is definitely going to come up again too, Senator Dick Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois, pressed him on that, in this issue of Trump in the White House. Did he ask you, did he make you promise, did he get a litmus test from you on this issue? And Justice Gorsuch replied, you know, I would have walked out of the Oval Office. And then he added something that will help this next nominee, too. He said, that's not appropriate for the White House or that end of Pennsylvania Avenue, and it's not appropriate for to be asked on this end of Pennsylvania Avenue either. And so judicial nominees have had this way of avoiding these questions, saying what their personal experience is.
I mean, Amy, it's interesting because we have not asked this question in many, many years, but back in the days of like 2005, 2006, most Americans wanted to know what court nominees felt about Roe v. Wade and abortion, and it'd be interesting to know if that's still the case.
Well, when I was talking to Senator Grassley, who of Iowa, he's a Republican who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee, he basically already said to me the nominee is going to follow the tradition that has been done, and so I think everybody's going to be a little frustrated At the end of the day, when this question.
So is there going to be then, we're going to see a lot of posturing, surprisingly, from senators with the questioning, trying to be that one person who cracks the justice, the potential justice?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that can go on for hours on end. But it happened that Gorsuch was very smooth and successful at avoiding some of those questions in his confirmation hearings and on the floor. Things moved really, I think, rather quickly.
Here's one of the tricks that Democrats have been trying to use in the lower court nominations, because Trump has put forward a bunch of nominees that the Democrats are opposed to, and they also say are you know, sort of in line to overturn Roe v. Wade or chip away at abortion protections. And one thing they do is they ask about Brown v. Board of Education, which is decades-old law that about desegregating schools. It's widely lauded as one of the country's best decisions. And if they say what they think about Brown v. Board of Education, then they can roll into the more controversial cases like Roe v. Wade. Well, if you answered Brown, why won't you answer Roe? So what you're going to see is a nominee that is going to be very guarded about answering any questions about any previous Supreme Court rulings. But there are a lot of other secondary things, I would say. One would be freedom of religion.
Yep.
There are a lot of cases going through now as to whether a baker has to bake a cake for a same-sex wedding. Does a photographer have to take photographs for a same-sex wedding? Do state employees have to serve people in their state who are in same-sex marriages? And so there's a lot of sort of these around-the-edges fringe freedom of religion issues. There's also free speech issues. One, there was a case last term that was free speech, but it was related to whether pregnancy centers in California had to post information about low-cost abortions. So these are the kind of issues that animate on the right.
I also think that collective bargaining issues are a real motivator on the right-hand side and for Mitch McConnell and the court, you know, cases that involve collective bargaining rights is something to watch, too.
McConnell has also been a huge in campaign finance reform and keeping any sort of limits on the money flowing into politics.
That's right.
Carol, we have about a little over a minute left. I want to get you to weigh in on whether a Supreme Court justice and the very public battle over that nomination, how this impacts voters and who's more likely than not to be influenced by this issue.
Well, I think, you know, what we've seen, we did our most recent polling on the midterms in early June, and this is already pretty much of a nationalized election already. I mean, we had a record share of voters saying that partisan control of Congress would be a factor in their vote already. And so I think it will intensify voters on both sides. I mean, one of the things we saw people to watch are younger women who favor the Democratic candidate by more than 40 points in our most recent polling, and how this issue of abortion and Roe v. Wade works with
Do you know
voters.
How it works right now with those voters, how they feel about it, and have those views about abortion changed?
Views on abortion have not changed much over the decades. In fact, unlike a lot of social issues like, say, same-sex marriage, we haven't seen much change on abortion. But younger women in particular are very supportive of keeping abortion legal.
I want to thank our guests for joining me. Todd Ruger from CQ and Roll Call, Nancy Ognatovich, a congressional leadership reporter for Bloomberg Government, and Carol Doherty. He's the director of political research at the Pew Research Center. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Amy.
Hi, my name's Gwen. I'm from Boston, Massachusetts. This court decision can really impact people's lives. You know, I'm a young LGBT woman, and I'm honestly afraid. I'm very afraid for what my future holds ahead of me now that there's going to be a conservative-leaning court for the next who knows how long.
You've been weighing in on Justice Kennedy's retirement, how you think it might affect you personally, and who should replace him and when.
Charlotte, North Carolina. I believe that they should absolutely go ahead and have the vote for the next Supreme Court justice based on the fact that it is not a presidential election. It is the president who should choose the nominee, not Congress, not Senate. The president, remember that.
Hi, this is Anna from Maynard. And I'm absolutely terrified that we'll see the end of Roe versus Wade if Trump gets to choose who the next Supreme Court justice is. I firmly believe that the Democrats should do exactly what the Republicans did and hold up the nomination until a Democrat is in office.
Last year, whenever Mitch McConnell decided that Merrick Garland wouldn't get a vote in the Senate, he said this was in order to let the people have an input in the next Supreme Court justice.
This is Judy Ingolito from Colorado Springs, Colorado. You know, we need to do, and Mitch McConnell needs to do, exactly what he fought so hard for just a year or so ago, and delay the appointment of a new Supreme Court justice until after the elections and the newly elected members of Congress of the Senate are sworn in.
This is Jose Manuel from Orlando, Florida. I think the Supreme Court justice should be selected and voted on right away.
This is Justin from St. Louis, Missouri. The idea of a magical progressive Supreme Court is a myth. It's an inherently conservative organization made of successful and established people every time.
Yeah, hi, my name is Paul. I'm calling from St. George, Utah, and it's really interesting to watch the liberal Democrats enduring the same thing that us conservatives endured during the Obama administration. I'm not saying one is right or wrong. It's just interesting to see everything flipped way the other way.
At this point, all the energy and actions focused on the process. Who's going to be chosen? When will the vote take place? Which senators can be persuaded? There's going to be an enormous amount of money spent trying to sway the decisions of just 3 to 4 senators. But in less than 5 months, the action is going to move to the ballot box. Republicans are hopeful that the addition of another conservative Supreme Court justice will be just the shot of adrenaline they need to motivate their voters. There's empirical and anecdotal evidence that more Republicans than Democrats base their 2016 vote on the Supreme Court. Of course, it's also going to fire up and motivate the already engaged Democratic base. And it also may bring out younger voters to the polls that Democrats have had a hard time getting to vote in non-presidential years. A battle over abortion rights is likely to exacerbate the challenge Republicans and Trump already have with white suburban women. In fact, the most recent NBC Wall Street Journal poll found college-educated white women voters preferring a Democratic candidate by 30 points. Many of the most competitive House races in the country this year are in places like suburban Chicago, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, and New Jersey. But the battle for the Senate is taking place on much redder and more rural terrain. There are 5 Democrats up this fall who sit in states that Donald Trump carried by 19 points or more. Can those red state Democrats afford to buck a president who remains popular in their state? I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a constitutional scholar. What I do know is politics. But even I don't know how this issue is going to play out in 2018. And let's face it, by November, heck, by next week, we could have another issue emerge that's even more pressing or influential than this one. Coming up, our coverage continues as we turn to the fight over Roe v. Wade and get the conservative view on the fight for the Supreme Court. And we always want to hear from you. Give us a call with your reaction to Justice Kennedy's retirement at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can tweet me at Amy E. Walter or at The Takeaway. Justice Kennedy has been the key vote in many decisions, but perhaps none have been as divisive and as politically important to both liberals and conservatives as his position on abortion.
Justice Kennedy has been a legal bulwark protecting women's right to an abortion since he got on the court, and that was surprising.
Emily Bazelon is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. Could a new justice give the court the votes it needs to overturn Roe v. Wade?
The smart play for the conservatives on the court is not to gut Roe versus Wade in one fell swoop, though they certainly could. There are already states that are passing bans that ban abortion at 6 weeks. That's effectively banning it entirely. And the court could take one of those cases and say, yes, this ban is constitutional. And then that would be a kind of immediate end to Roe versus Wade. In my scenario, Roe doesn't technically get overturned, but instead, the court opens the door to states passing laws that make it harder and harder for clinics to stay open, and that has almost equal effect.
Well, aren't we already somewhat at that place where, depending on where you live in this country right now, your access to abortion services is different.
Yes, that is true. However, every state has at least one clinic open. There is a blue city or a blue-ish city in every state with an abortion clinic.
So what you're saying is we could be looking at a point where even those blue cities would no longer have a clinic open.
Absolutely. When you think of the map of the United States and the large areas of territory that are deep red in terms of our politics, you could imagine thousands of miles of the United States without an abortion clinic.
And so the societal impact is we're literally two Americas when it comes to the issue of abortion, which will still be considered a constitutional right?
Well, you could have a constitutional right that is completely empty, right? For example, if you allowed a state to make it so hard and prohibitively expensive to open an abortion clinic because of the number of regulations, all the hoops they have to jump from, you would close all the abortion clinics in states that wanted to enact those kinds of regulations. And then, yes, we would have two Americas, because at least until the conservative majority outlaws abortion entirely and allows doctors and women to be prosecuted for abortion, right? That's another step. In the middle is a situation in which blue states that want to preserve the right to abortions do so, and red states that don't have clinics. And then it will be interesting to see what the purple states, where they land in all of this.
And that the Supreme Court's role in that is to say, look, it's not up to us, it's up to your state.
That's right. And that's what we had before Roe versus Wade, a world of wildly inconsistent access.
So that what we could be looking at is a world that was like 40 years ago, where there's inconsistent law, but there is still Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it could also be that I'm wrong and all of these incremental strategies I'm talking about are not of that much interest to Chief Justice Roberts, and they just like take the big swing and say that Roe versus Wade was a terrible mistake. But that would just be a much more politically energizing move for them to make. And I just wonder if Roberts really wants to go there.
I think he would be completely unwilling to have a 5-4 majority against Roe v. Wade after all of these years.
That's Ben Domenech, founder and publisher of The Federalist, who, like Emily Bazelon, is skeptical that Roe v. Wade will be immediately overturned by a new Supreme Court bench.
I do think that's going to be the narrative from here till Election Day. The media has already decided that that's the narrative. But from my perspective, Kennedy was not the deciding vote in between those two things. Now, what that doesn't speak to is the potential for another court vacancy. You have, multiple older, members from the liberal side. So the potential for a 6-3 ruling against Roe after, either the passing or the retirement of another justice, I think that I would be far more willing to consider in either a rifle shot way or in another way.
And conservatives, there are many who believe that getting a conservative justice means they want to see Roe v. Wade overturned. So is there pressure on those conservatives to see an immediate reaction, right? Or at least to sell it as, here is a way for us to once and for all have Roe v. Wade taken off.
I think that's an open question at the moment. And there are going to be a lot of people out there, I think, who could be disappointed if they do nominate someone and then discover, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, that whatever case they put before the Supreme Court, whether it's a fetal pain case or something like that, ends up with, Chief Justice Roberts being the swing vote for the other side.
How do you think this impacts the court's rulings going forward?
I think that this resignation at this particular time is a sign that Justice Kennedy was very concerned about the aspect of his legacy related to free speech and religious freedom. If you look at the 5-4 decisions that they had running down the gamut right as he was going out the door, it was speech issue after speech issue after speech issue. He views the Masterpiece case as a speech issue. He views the Janus Union dues case as a speech issue. And I think one of the reasons that he chose this moment to retire was that he was concerned about what a potential Democrat-appointed justice in his place would do on those speech counts, given that it was 5-4, 5-4, 5-4 on all these different decisions. For conservatives,
meaning that they were going to go too far to the left.
Exactly. That he was concerned that in any Democrat appointee, if he waited until the next presidency, would be someone who would take these things in a direction that he doesn't want to see them go, which is kind of a libertarian close to a career that has been, fairly all over the map politically. I mean, this is a guy who, has, I think, been the most influential vote on the court for the past 25 to 30 years, but not necessarily the most influential jurist in the sense that his opinions are not necessarily cited as frequently as others that were written in the majority. And he's not really thought of in that capacity. It's more where his vote was. I think that Kennedy leaving at this moment is going to absolutely lead to a greater investment by conservative voters of all stripes in this political cycle.
And what do you think it does, though, on the other side? I mean, we're already starting to see clearly what the battle lines are going to be.
Yeah.
For the left, it's going to be abortion rights.
Yes.
And this is an issue that has not been litigated in an election, really, in my lifetime.
Yeah.
So do you see that it may actually, where the energy may be coming from, is from the left in a way that we have not seen before versus the right, where the court has been a rallying cry mm-hmm. for a long time?
I think that's there's certainly some truth to that. But I think the problem for Democrats is that was already the most activated portion of their base, I feel like, going into this cycle, young women particularly, where we see that margin already going in a significant way. The problem for them, as I see it, is if Mitch McConnell is able to do what he intends to do here and push through a court nominee by, say, October.
Do you think that's what's going to happen?
I do think that is what's likely to happen, assuming that they don't make a mistake in terms of their approach to this. If they push that through, think about how depressing that has to be. You know, I saw, you know, the comments from so many different Democrats, you know, in the media and running for elected office and in elected office saying, you know, we've got to pull out all the stops to prevent this from happening. But the number of things that they can do in that regard is very limited.
Right.
And I view that as being a potential situation where if they're not able to stop somebody before the election, that could be a significant depressant to people who have been really engaged and feel like Democrats should stand up on this issue.
So this is only Act One, right?
Yes.
Where you nominate and then confirm a justice. Act Two, of course, is cases come before the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. In Act Three, they decide those cases, and there's a reaction to that in public. From a conservative perspective, what is the wish list? What's the greatest hope that a court would or could do in 2019 and 2020?
Well, I think, you know, in terms of a wish list, the issues that I think have been in front of the court regularly over the course of the past couple of years have actually been a real bulwark against government expansion and invasion of individual liberty. The attitude that I think a lot of conservatives have, and we saw this, frankly, in the decision process when it came to supporting Donald Trump, is that the representative bodies of the U.S. government really don't function anymore, that we are ruled effectively by a judiciary and an administrative state.
Yeah, and now
a bureaucracy.
The executive.
Yeah. Yes, and that basically, so all that matters is the bureaucracy and who's in charge of the courts, which is why so many people, even if they didn't like Donald Trump, made a big bet on him. Now I think they view this as an opportunity to hold the courts as a bulwark against government expansion for potentially a generation, not just given the appointments of the president to the Supreme Court, but given the lengthy roster of federal court appointees that he has done of young and extremely intelligent, well-regarded, and sort of people who have the right resumes to do those jobs and to be in those positions for a long time.
The other issue that folks on the left are talking about is Obamacare and health care and the impact of the Supreme Court on that decision. Do you expect that this Supreme Court could ultimately have an impact in doing more to undo the law?
Well, from my perspective, the Supreme Court made a completely bollocksed in a sort of answer to the healthcare laws decision. They supported and upheld the part of the law that was working the least in terms of the tax authority to support changes done within the individual market. And they struck down by 7-2, not by just the conservatives, the Medicaid expansion, which was the part of the law that was quote unquote working, that was signing people up at least, and that was getting people coverage. That just speaks to the court's ignorance when it comes to the way that healthcare policy works. But I do think there could be additional areas of battles within this space, particularly when it comes to issues as we move forward within state markets, where, you know, we have to keep in mind this Medicaid expansion slowly phases out and you have state budgets that are going to be obligated to cover these various things. That's going to result in additional lawsuits. There's also going to be questions as it relates to hospital monopolies and other insurance monopolies within the states that's going to be litigated within the next couple of years. And that, I think, is all going to be factors that will speak to not necessarily the rollback of Obamacare, but its evolution as people try to make this system work.
Obviously, a lot of folks are going to be pouring a lot of money into this issue on both sides to influence the debate. But is there anybody really to influence?
If you're someone like Joe Manchin, Donald Trump has the popularity he does in his state. He's up against a more significant opponent than he had perhaps hoped for. I think this could factor into it. I think if you're Joe Donnelly, as I said, it could be something that could sway you just to say, you know, if we're not going to be able to successfully filibuster a nominee, I might as well go along with it and potentially hold my Senate seat. The big question, I think, is going to be Lisa Murkowski and whether she can be brought along or bought or in some way convinced by the nominee that, you know what, this, we realize you may have some differences with us when it comes to Roe, when it comes to some other issues related to Western policy and things like that. But can she be convinced? You know, Murkowski is someone who has, you know, historically been fairly gettable on things like this, where it's a party loyalty factor, but more recently has sounded different notes. And so it could potentially be a situation there where she tries to extract something from the president. And then, of course, there's always the guys who are headed out the door, like Bob Corker and Jeff Flake. That said, I think in order for Jeff Flake to stand up in this regard, it would require a spine, something that I'm not sure that he has in great deal.
You didn't mention Susan Collins.
I don't think of Susan Collins as gettable on this. I think that her situation is such that, given her prominence on the abortion issue within the conference, it would be very difficult to get her vote with anybody who had any kind of record on that. And that could include, in the case of some of these, just being Catholic. And that's something that I think is going to be a real challenge. She did vote for Gorsuch, obviously, saying he was very qualified, but I think that was a different situation. I view her as less gettable than Murkowski.
And do you think that even for the Democrats that voted for Gorsuch last time, knowing that he was going to vote a certain way on Roe v. Wade that was more conservative than they believed, that they can say this time, well, I'm going to vote against the nominee because of abortion?
I think it could be hard for someone like Donnelly to do that, you know, in particular. But the truth is, the Democratic Party right now, I think, and this has been revealed by all the primaries that you've been covering over the past several months, they are having a real crisis in terms of figuring out what their identity is going to be. You saw a run of primaries in Colorado, in Maryland, in New York, obviously, where very progressive candidates, in the case of New York, I would say even a radical candidate, you know, won, promising a lot of different things. They promised to, you know, work to abolish ICE, work to achieve Medicare for all, a lot of goals that, you know, go even beyond what Bernie Sanders has been saying over the years. And that's up against a party on the other side that has been more globally minded, more pro-business in the past several decades, more mindful of trying to, you know, have that approach to things. This is a real question of whether the party is going to be beholden to the progressive left that says you have to fight President Trump no matter what, on every issue, pull out all the stops, do whatever it takes. In this situation, there's not that much they can do. So what kind of Democrat do you want to be?
Ben Domenech, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Amy.
Ben Domenech, founder and publisher of The Federalist. President Trump will appoint a second Supreme Court justice not even 2 years into his presidency. But while Justice Kennedy's retirement's receiving a lot of attention, it's not the only way Donald Trump is transforming the judiciary. He's making a record number of appointments of judges to federal courts across the country. Here to talk about those appointments is David Latt, an attorney and founding editor of Above the Law. David, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
David, we're looking at a situation now where President Trump is going to name a second Supreme Court justice. How unprecedented is that situation?
It is unusual to have two Supreme Court appointments so early in one's term, 18 months in roughly. So it's not unusual for a president to have two or more Supreme Court appointments. Barack Obama did, George W. Bush did, but to have them this early is unusual.
And we know that when the president came into office, there were many, many openings for him to fill in the lower federal courts. Can you talk to us about how that happened and why that happened?
When President Trump came into office, he inherited around 100 vacancies on the lower federal courts. This was a significantly higher number than past presidents. Barack Obama inherited a little over 50. George W. Bush inherited around 80. And one of the reasons that Trump inherited so many vacancies is because Republicans had used various tactics politically to prevent President Obama from filling many open seats. The most famous example, of course, is Merrick Garland's nomination to the Supreme Court. But it was happening on the lower federal courts, too, left and right.
But I thought that the decision by then Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, a Democrat, to lower the threshold needed to be able to confirm lower court justices helped to push a lot of these judges along.
Yes, there were some procedural changes that helped the Obama administration get some judges confirmed. In 2013, the Senate Democrats, by majority vote, got rid of the filibuster for lower court judicial nominees, meaning that you needed just 51 votes to get a nominee confirmed as opposed to the 60 votes needed to overcome a filibuster. So that did help. But there was another mechanism still in place called blue slips, in which home state senators could essentially block the nomination of a nominee from their state. And this blue slip practice was used by Republicans in states where Obama had nominees to prevent those nominees from going forward. And in some cases, the White House, after consulting with the senators, wouldn't even bother nominating someone because they knew that the home state senators would not approve, would not turn in their blue slips. Earlier this year, the Republicans, Senator Grassley, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, essentially removed blue slips as well. And as a result, Democrats have very few mechanisms now to block further nominees from getting confirmed in the lower courts.
So how many lower federal court vacancies have been filled? And can you talk to us a little bit about who these justices are? What do we know about them?
So President Trump has filled roughly 42 judgeships in his year and a half or so in office, which is a staggering number. In his first year in office, he essentially set a record for the most judges confirmed, certainly federal appellate judges, the tier one below the Supreme Court, in a president's first year.
So, like ever?
Yes, I believe that is true.
Wow.
At first, people were trying to say, well, is it the past couple of decades? But actually, if you go back to the founding of the Republic, it seems that in terms of, now granted, you can also, there weren't always these intermediate courts, but essentially, he has set a record for federal appellate judges in a president's first year. And a lot of lower court judges, too, a lot of district or trial court judges. There have been more than around 42 or so confirmations to date. But vacancies have continued to grow under President Trump. A lot of judges have retired. Some have passed away. So even though he inherited around 100 and he's filled around 40, there are now around 150 vacancies for him to fill. So even though he has done a lot and he has delivered a lot to his base, he still has a lot more that he could still do.
And what do we know about these justices? Is I know there are, you know, there are 42 of them, so they're all unique, but is there something that ties them together?
I would say that they have three major qualities. One, they are quite conservative, and perhaps even more conservative than nominees of a typical Republican administration, because Trump didn't cut as many sort of patronage deals to reward, say, campaign fundraisers or political allies, because he came into office with very few fundraisers and allies. So he could kind of go for a certain ideological purity in his nominees. Second, I would say they are young. Republicans focus on youth when it comes to judicial nominees, which I think Democrats would be well advised to do as well. That's true of the Supreme Court. It's true of the lower courts as well.
And the third, because these are lifetime appointments.
Yes. So these judges serve for life. So if you get a 35 or 40-year-old in there, that person could be serving for half a century. And then the third factor I would say about these nominees is they have been very highly qualified. They have been very well credentialed. There have been a couple of high profile blowups, but for the most part, these judges come from very highly regarded law schools. They've clerked for federal judges. They've worked at major law firms. They have government experience. They hit all of the boxes you'd be looking for in terms of federal judicial nominees.
And finally, for us regular people, what does it mean when we think about these lower courts? What influence do they have over our lives? Because we talk so much about the Supreme Court, but where do the lower courts fit in?
The lower courts are hugely influential. And I think this is in some ways the overlooked or untold story about Trump and judges. We focus so much on the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court hears 70, 80 cases a year. For the many thousands of federal cases that are floating through the system, the lower courts are the last stop. That's where it ends. The vast majority of cases never make it up to the Supreme Court. So these lower courts are basically deciding the constitutional rights and obligations and entitlements of people all around the country. They're hugely, hugely important.
So our expectation is, when you talk about they are conservative, is this going to be on social issues? Is this on legal issues? Where do you think their influence is going to be most noticed?
I would say conservative in terms of their judicial philosophy. Many of them are in the mold of the late Justice Scalia. They are originalists. They are textualists. They focus on the text of the Constitution or the law. They focus on the original public meaning of the provision at issue. I think that is one thing that unites them. In terms of their personal politics, they are a mixed group. But if they are committed to these ideas of originalism and textualism, they would say, our personal politics don't matter. We're just focused on interpreting and applying the law.
David Latt, thank you so very much. David Latt's an attorney, founding editor of Above the Law, a legal news website. Thanks again, David.
Hey, thank you.
And before we leave you today, we want to take a moment to reflect on Thursday's shooting at the Capital Gazette in Annapolis, Maryland. 5 employees were killed and 3 were injured in this targeted attack. Employees who were at work, doing their jobs as they would on any ordinary day, when they came under fire. The Capital Gazette is one of the oldest newspapers in the country, and from its founding, the local community was its focus. In 1776, the paper published the Declaration of Independence on page 2. The front page was dedicated to local news. Today, these journalists cover the city's tax hikes and sports games, PTA meetings and local races. They report so that people can remain informed. And their commitment to this mission was laid bare when Capital Gazette papers lined doorsteps across Maryland just hours after the shooting, coverage of a tragedy that happened in their own house. There's lots of talk about the climate journalists are living in. During a time when powerful and influential people, like the President of the United States, refer to the free press as the enemy of the people. But the work that journalists do is invaluable to a free and open democracy. The media isn't perfect, but it's necessary. And that's why today, I speak for myself and my team at The Takeaway, when I say we stand in solidarity with the Capital Gazette, sending our support and hope that they can eventually start to heal. Our lines are always open. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Amy Walter. This is The Takeaway.